are Prince and a perfect way to actually sort of come out of Jo Hamilton with, of course, Fractal Sparks and her fantastic virtuoso air piano. Amazing. Anyway, if you've actually focused on a virtuoso air piano and all sorts of other bits and pieces, you can, of course, see Jo Hamilton perform at the Lincoln Performing Arts Centre this coming Sunday. Where else do you go? Well, you add a cherry on top with a bit of brunch and you actually say, it's time for William Sidwell. William, how are you?
Yeah, morning, very well, thank you.
Excellent. Fine day and the brunch. Very much a phenomenon of the 1980s, I feel. But is it coming back? What's the sort of notion about brunch time, that kind of breakfast-lunch mash-up, really?
Well, the first thing I should say is, where's my ident?
Oh.
You know, I mean, what happened?
Yeah,
what happened
yeah.
to that? Okay.
Fair point.
Second thing is, the problem I have
yes.
is that I like an ordered day. Okay,
yes.
I like to start. I like to, and food is a wonderful thing. And if we can cut up the day with food, so you have breakfast, then you can go through the mid morning, and maybe you can stop for a cup of tea. Maybe you can have a biscuit,
mm-hmm.
and then it's lunch, and then lunch drifts on mm-hmm. to the afternoon, and the afternoon could be punctuated by a cup of tea and maybe some cake, and then there's dinner in the evening.
Yes,
brunch comes in mid morning for the slobs who haven't managed to get up in time for breakfast.
Mm.
It ruins your lunch, which means, therefore, you have no lunch because you haven't got an appetite. So what time then is dinner? You know, the whole point is, you know, the important thing about food is that we should gather together as communities, families, friends, break bread, look each other in the eye, and then deal with the problems of the world. Otherwise, chaos ensues. And brunch is the meal for bedraggled slobs who can't get up in time and that therefore should be banned.
Curiously, as with most portmanteau terms, it actually originated in England in the late 1800s when it was served in a buffet-style manner, but then became popular in the United States in the 1930s, according to our research here.
What research, or are you just Googling and looking at Wikipedia?
Oh, well, you know, it's one person's research is another person's, you know, search engine. You know, it's all there.
look, it doesn't matter where it came from, and fine, fair enough. If it was a Victorian invention, which I find very hard to believe, since the Victorians, being Puritans, definitely would have wanted to get up for breakfast. You know, there was a man called Dr. Henry Pye Chavass who tried to ban puddings for children, you know, saying that it would sort of divert them from the true course of life if they just hung around waiting for sweet, delicious things. So I find it hard to believe that it's a... I can't believe the Victorians invented brunch. I'm very happy to blame the Americans, because it's a sort of slangy thing that people from the United States would come up with. So let's blame the Americans for it. But the problem is, it's so entrenched here. I mean, so many restaurants are making a fortune out of it. Mainly, it has to be said, because it's a good way of cleaning out your fridge.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a chef, you can churn out a load of lazy items and give it to the unshaven masses. Give them a Bloody Mary and, you know, reap in the money.
Looking at some of the other international aspects here, William, we see that the dim sum brunch is popular in Chinese restaurants worldwide, consisting of a variety of stuffed buns, dumplings, and other savoury or sweet food items that have been steamed, deep-fried, or baked. That's the dim sum brunch. And in Dubai, apparently, Friday brunch is considered something of an institution.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, of course, Friday in Dubai is Saturday.
Indeed.
For
yeah.
us,
yes.
because their days of rest are
yeah.
are Friday and Saturday. What they do is, in order to get people to pile into their restaurants, they do these sort of amazing deals, because alcohol is so expensive over there. You know, anyone living in Dubai gets well paid, because there's no taxation. You get 100% on your payslip, which is pretty extraordinary. But you pay through the nose when it comes to booze. So what these places do, in order to fill themselves, fill up the spaces, they do these all-you-can-eat and all-you-can-drink brunch things, so that you know the hard-working Dubai types pile in mid-morning and feast. You know, it's a nice idea. I think the problem comes when you're getting crusty like me and you have kids, which means you have to get up for breakfast. And also, I think it's really important that you dine with your children. So my children wake up in the morning, they're hungry, so we sit down together. And that's probably around, you know, I don't know, 8:30. If we're lucky, they're pretty wake up starving. So if you eat with your children, which I think everyone should, because it's just better for society and conversation and, you know, no screens at the table, blah, 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 that's another conversation for another day,
well,
then, you know, you're not hungry enough for brunch.
Ali Hope would say he couldn't agree more with you from your Facebook update here. Loathsome adventure, according to Ali, runs into two otherwise ruins two otherwise excellent meals, as you rightly said, Richard. Jennifer Middleton, on the other hand, English people in their inflexible ways.
Half the fun is, I think, you know, it says you're inflexible, but I think you need to be flexible when it's civilized to do so. I just don't know. I just don't understand when I'm supposed to eat this meal. You know, I mean, what's the next? Drunch? You know, drunch is halfway between lunch and dinner, isn't it?
Yes,
drunch.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I call that tea.
I would have said high tea, possibly. I mean, there's high tea.
Yeah, I mean, my children, you know, in the holidays they have tea, and that can be quite substantial. You know, they can have pasta, but then they want dinner as well. Yeah,
and
after 8 o'clock.
Lashings and lashings of ginger ale, of course.
Of course, yeah. I mean, we pour the stuff over them.
Again, the article itself, which is the essence of this, you can go and find via the Telegraph under the headline "A Lazy Vulgar Rip Off: It's Time to Ban Brunch." I must admit, the photo does you justice there, William. It's sort of you're looking mean and moody as you're tucking in to the whole
thing. That was the idea. That was the idea. Actually, we started this discussion on this new radio show that I have on Soho Radio.
Yep.
Which could never rival your great station.
I see it as complimentary.
Quality,
William. Complimentary.
Yes, there we go. And we started that off as a chat and then did the piece in the Telegraph. I mean, it's funny. It's extraordinary. You look at the Telegraph, you look at the comments that appear below that piece. They're getting as bad as the Mail Online. I was accused of plagiarism. There was a similar piece someone spotted in the New York Times, but it was just about the same subject. I mean, word for word, it was not stolen at all. And you, coming from an academic background, of course, would be hot on plagiarism.
Exactly, exactly.
And as a journalist who has some sort of merit, I don't normally try and steal other people's writing. But
it's not cut
but it
and
paste. Has it has it exactly it does. You know, it's funny. I occasionally alight on these issues of utter triviality, whether it's square plates or whatever. And it gets the nation thinking, I think. You know, sometimes things that are of no importance take on new important significance when the world is a gloomy and terrible place.
And who would have thought that we'd be considering seriously Le Drunch as an emerging dining trend adopted by fashionable food-loving Parisians as the perfect way to enjoy a laid-back, leisurely afternoon?
I mean, I think, you know, the thing is, do you remember a few years ago there was the experts were advising on the idea of grazing. That's the best thing, so that, you know, as I've written in the Telegraph, your desk is a strewn mess of dried apricots and nuts and quality chocolate. But it's just not good for you. I think you should eat more at the beginning of the day and graduate that down so the portions decrease as the day goes on, which will give you a better night's sleep. I'm not saying I always do that.
It was, of course, a cliche, breakfast like a king and then dine like a pauper at the end of the day. That was the steps you actually took.
Absolutely.
All sort of cliche. Coming up next, we'll be speaking to gaming expert from Family Gamer TV, Andy Robertson. I don't know, William, if you've ever had the anxiety or stress of selecting inappropriate video games for your children, or whether you'd stop them from children video games in any way, shape or form.
Let me tell you something. I loathe the iPad. I think it's a heinous, terrible thing, and it just doesn't encourage intelligent thought. So I don't know. Read your books. Yeah. Don't play games.
It's a tablet which will make you need more tablets just to actually cope with the headaches caused by the first tablet.
Precisely.
It's like a logic there, but it's sort of through there. William,
One more thing. I'm just going to say, we had these amazing guys on my show from Rutland Charcuterie, who are producing British products, you know, sausages, dried hams, meats, incredible. Every bit as good as Parma ham. And I just want to say hello to them, and I think you should get them on your show.
William, any Sitwell recommendation, as you know, has got that golden realm of positivity, and we're more than happy. It's like a platinum seal of approval. And in fact, speaking of platinum seals of approval, Sarah Heseltine will be with us in the very near future, where she'll be talking about current events that the Gatepost have been up to. So great stuff. They had a fine debut a few weeks back, both Sarah and indeed Hattie. So great stuff there as far as the Gatepost is concerned. But for the moment, well, we would be remiss if we didn't do this.
The finest in gourmet criticism and foodie delights, and the author of A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Quite clearly a question of quality personified. It's William Sitwell on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Well, you're quite right. Obviously, we need to update it a bit and sort of, you know, add to various other bits and pieces. So ident is the kind of reverse. We're sort of just playing around with the concept. But have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Always as ever, thank you.
And I take it we can look forward to connecting with you again next week, actually, after her trip to the palace, because we spoke to her on the train from Peterborough. Jessica Ward is en route to St James's Palace for her Gold Duke of Edinburgh Award. Jessica will hopefully be back in the system with us.
Great, and I'll be, hopefully, you would have landed from Hong Kong, and I'll be on your show.
There you go. William Sitwell, as ever, we salute you.
Seems like yesterday, but it was long ago. Jane, it was lovely, she was...
Only with living, if somebody is loving you, baby, now you do.
Admittedly, it might be seen as a bit of a cliche to actually go in with Lana Del Rey and video games, but what the hey, never shy away from it as long as it's got a Peggy rating. One of the key aspects that we've spoken about already on the show today is this news that a quarter of parents in the East Midlands feel that gaming supports their children's education. However, nearly a fifth of parents feel that gaming has no benefit at all to their children, as well as being very confused about ratings and such like stuff. To address this and talk about whether it's going to be all fun and games this Christmas and the best way to actually ensure that games can be appropriately put together, we're delighted to welcome gaming expert extraordinaire from Family Gamer TV, the fantastically wonderful soul whose name is Andy Robertson. Andy, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine.
Good to connect with you. Now, this particular sort of piece here in terms of... It's almost a generational gap thing whereby, you know, you don't want to be sort of handing out Call of Duty 4 or 5 or Halo to, shall we say, a six-year-old. Because it's not really going to be appropriate in any way, shape or form. And it's quite astounding that this particular survey suggests, according to one poll, that 3 in 5 parents admit they have no understanding of the PEGI age ratings.
Yes, it was research that has been commissioned by GAME. I think it's interesting because it shows there's a real mix of understanding. Some parents seeing games as very positive, but some still feeling quite confused. So that, you know, I'm often suggesting ways that parents can get more engaged with games to close that gap.
And in terms of that whole system, I mean, you know, clearly, mentioned in the first part of the programme that, you know, is this what several million years of evolution have actually brought to us, the whole notion of opposable thumbs to actually get onto to PlayStations and so on. There is an educational aspect to sort of games, etc. So there is a good side to the story, isn't there?
Yeah, I think like any medium, really, games offer a whole range of experiences. Some of those can be educational, some of those can be engaging and relational, and some of those, you know, are more focused on entertainment. And by families engaging in what games have to offer, they can sort of pick and choose which game is going to be best suited for them. And there's this new section in game stores, Game Junior, that's a great way for families, mums and dads, to sort of get up to speed with the new games and what's coming this Christmas that's going to be a good fit for their family.
One of the reasons we're obviously delighted to feature you on the programme today is because the whole game industry is a huge business. I mean, it's overtaking the kind of dream factory of Hollywood and a range of other things. I mean, this is something which is, you know, as far as the Western world is concerned, and actually globally, something which is really vital. And clearly, pester power can pay a line in terms of what people actually want for their own particular games and so on.
Yeah, so I mean, we've seen in terms of the sort of cultural significance as well, games starting to eclipse things like movies, particularly in the sort of the mind of children. So as a parent, you need to understand, you know, which games are up and coming, which games are going to offer the experience that you want to have in your home. So that Game Junior section in store and also online at game.co.uk/Game Junior. I've been working on some videos there that offer parents sort of first-hand advice on how to get up to speed, but how to sort of get the games in the home that they are going to be comfortable playing and that will get them involved and create a positive experience.
I love your top 4 tips for actually coping with safe gaming, which clearly is something which is at the heart of a whole range of things. First of all, use the information on the box, such as the PEGI rating, to understand what each game is like. It's kind of from the Department of the Blind and the Obvious, actually, but it nevertheless needs to be stated. And also spend some time researching the game by reading online or indeed check out the trailer, and also find out how other parents handle games in their family. And finally, of course, the thing which hopefully will be used by most game stores, of course, ask advice. advice in your local store.
Yeah, I think going to places like Game Genie, you'll find the staff are actually really well trained, not just in the games that are sort of for the hardcore gamers, but for a whole range of games. So if you go in as a parent and say, look, I've got kids of a certain age, they'll be able to come back and say, well, have you tried these experiences that would be a good fit for your family? And all those PEGI ratings, it can sound like it's sort of straightforward, but actually you do need to sort of pay attention to what's happening on the box, because there is a lot of really useful information. If you then go online and do a bit of research, whether that's watching video game videos or looking up those ratings on the PEGI site, you get to see why a particular game has received a particular rating, and you're in on that background information.
One of the areas which I must admit I was quite envious of folk who are, shall we say, slightly less chronologically gifted, is the range of games that are present for younger generations, including the Marvel Disney Infinity organisation, Super Smash Brothers, and of course the Skylanders Trap Team Dark Edition. Are there any favourites there that you have personally, in terms of you say, yeah, actually I think Marvel Disney Infinity is really good?
Yeah, there's a new trend in sort of crossing over toys and video games. So the game comes with a toy and the toy unlocks content in the game. And Disney Infinity is an example of that, and Skylanders. Yeah. And, you know, my kids get a lot out of playing those games. And what I like about it is it's not just playing on the screen, but you take the toys and they play with them as much on the living room carpet, making up their own adventures with the games as they do sort of in the electronic experience on the screen.
Would you suggest setting time limits to the amount of time that children should actually spend on games? This is really to address the issue that has also been raised in the programme, that maybe children spend too much time playing with games when they should actually be playing outside in the real world, in flesh world, for instance.
Yeah, I think like any sort of hobby in the home, you want to have time limits. And this has been the subject of one of the videos that I created for Game Junior. And there's various ways which you as a family can sit down and decide how long is appropriate for you to be playing. And some of the consoles have a setting of a parental controls where you can set a timer so that the game automatically pauses when the time is up. And what I've done in my family is sit down with the kids and say, how long do you think you should play? So when the game runs out of time, it's not the parents coming in and sort of with a big stick telling them to stop, but it's the children themselves that are sort of self-policing. And that seems to work really well.
Makes perfect sense. And I've got to ask you, Andy, are there times where, when the children have been put to bed and they've been sorted through, etc., you secretly like to actually go and dig out the Halo or the Call of Duty or the shall we say, more mature games and actually get, or indeed FIFA, or any of the multifarious games that are actually out there?
Yeah, I'm quite a FIFA fan. And one of the things that's driving that is my 9-year-old son has been playing FIFA with me. And so I'll often practice once he's gone to bed to try and catch him up.
It's always a line, it's just astounding. A reminder, if people actually want to find out about the videos, they can go on YouTube and literally just type in Andy Robertson or just Family Gamer TV. What's the best way forward to access these things?
On YouTube, they can just Google Family Gamer TV, but there's some great videos that we've got up at the moment at game.co.uk/GameJunior, and there's some really sort of family-focused advice and videos there too.
So game.co.uk. Andy, there's always something wonderful about complementary media, where you actually have the Marconi-launched radio medium actually sharing with us the notion of the computer-based, binary-digital-oriented world. So two final questions for you. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition today? Has it been OK for you?
It's been very engaging. Thanks a lot.
That's very good. Well, to ensure that sort of interaction is very good to these kind of things. So the next critical one is, can we hopefully look forward to maybe featuring you again, maybe post-Christmas, in terms of seeing how things and games can continue to sort of have a beneficial effect on the world, and also how you can use them and really find out the most appropriate games for appropriate ages. Will you return?
Yeah, get me back, and I'd like to hear what games you play.
Well, we'll go there. Andy Robertson, many thanks indeed. Take care. We'll speak soon. Cheers, Dad.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, that was great. Cheers, Dad.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52. Lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
Oh, oh.
They took the credit for your second symphony, rewritten by machine on new technology. And now I understand the problems you could see.
Oh, oh.
I met your children.
Oh, oh.
But now we meet in an abandoned studio. We hear the playback and it seems
School of English and Journalism, where we can actually host freelance guest speakers. In fact, guest speakers from all over the wonderful world of communications. We're delighted to be able to welcome to the Siren Studio, indeed the Midweek Drive show, the fantastic individual. His name is Jane Hunt. Jane, best freelance PR practitioner, managing director of Catapult PR. Just an all-round wonderful person. Welcome along. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I don't know how I follow that, really. Very well, thank you.
Very critical. I think when we last had the sort of count-up, we've got 35 awards that we're talking about in terms
I
of
know
Catapult?
23.
23, all right. Yes. Oh, well, the other 12 obviously will be sorted through in terms
but
of
lots
that,
of certificates I don't count.
Oh, well,
so
there we yes. are. You see, well over that. So what is the secret of your success? I mean, an undergraduate originally reading history at the University of Cambridge.
Yes.
And from thence, obviously, to become one of the nation's favourites when it comes to PR practice and really getting the right balance of the campaign, the client and the magic that happens when you introduce the general public as well.
I think what you said there is really important, because I think the client has played a big part in our success, because I've always worked for clients who are willing to take a bit of risk, and so I've come up with creative ideas, but they were willing to run with them. And so I've been quite lucky, I think, in the people I've worked for. There's nothing worse for working for somebody and having lots of ideas, but they won't actually implement them. So I would say that the clients have played a very big part in my success.
One of the magical areas that I thought was sensational just from a recent masterclass you delivered was the Battle of Tastings, which all had to do with marmalade. Just
yes,
share
indeed.
With us a little bit about that.
The Battle of Tastings was something that I invented for the World's Original Marmalade Festival, which takes place at a place called Dalmain, which is a stately home in Penrith. The lady's passionate about marmalade, and she has different categories for people to enter their marmalade into. So one of them is a B&B category that she struggled to get people to enter. So I decided that we'd have our Battle of Tastings, obviously playing on the name of Hastings, and we would go around the country. I selected media in all the seaside resorts around Britain's coastline and targeted their media, inciting ladies to take up their wooden spoons and make their marmalade and do it for their seaside resort.
It's the simplicity of the idea that makes it so effective. Do you find that kind of crucial in so many ways? I mean, we hear the sort of keep it simple maxim often trotted out when it comes to campaigns, etc. But is it that kind of ultimately generates the most memorable images and campaigns?
Yeah, I think it's simplicity with a spin, really. And the simpler you can make it, obviously, the more it's going to be understood by people. But if you can do something clever with it, that's quite important. But I think also the spirit of competition is really important in that case, because people didn't want to let their resort down. And the Marmalade Festival got more entries than ever that year, so it really worked for them and for the charity that it supports.
You produced, obviously, a fantastic book. We didn't mention this in the introduction. Rogue Elephants, : One PR Girl's Fight Through the Human Jungle.
Indeed.
Sounds very exciting.
I think I wanted to communicate, really, that PR isn't all sort of one long joyride, that there are lots of ups and downs that have taken place during my career and through my life. And really, it came about because when I won the 2012 CIPR Best Freelance PR Practitioner Award, I had to go to a panel interview in London, and the man there who was on the chair of the panel, he had no idea really about regional PR, sort of looked at me as if I was slightly strange when I said I put on pink wellies and go up farm tracks to talk to people about their farm tourism business. And in the end I said to him, well, you've got to imagine it's a little bit like PR's version of It Shouldn't Happen to a Vet. And he took an intake of breath and said, oh, well, perhaps you should write a book about it. So I left there quite depressed because I got there late because a man had strapped explosives to himself and had closed off Tottenham Court Road. So I wasn't able
PR
to get
campaign,
there.
Isn't it, really?
Indeed. Especially as he just didn't get his HGV license, and that was the reason. But I was quite depressed when I left there. I didn't think I stood on earth of winning the award, and thought, well, if only I could write that book, because I saw a niche for somebody to actually explain PR in the real world rather than gin and tonic land.
One of the classic lines that come across suddenly from one element of PR, of course, is the absolutely fabulous sort of campaign, which clearly, in a sense, as you've just demonstrated, is complete sort of generational sort of aspect from that point of view. But that notion of creativity is still important, and actually getting that additional sort of spin. Fascinated in terms of how you kind of have channeled your history background and transferable skills there at Cambridge into actually coming up with a lot of creative ideas. We mentioned obviously the marmalade one, there are heaps of others. There's the yellow bananas one, which is another classic one.
Yes, I think I was quite lucky again at university because I had a very inspirational tutor who was totally different from anybody I'd ever met. He was a bit eccentric. He was very creative himself in the way that he would deliver his lectures. And I suppose, you know, I've just always had really inspirational people teaching me who have taught me to use my mind, to accept that there's no such word as can't, for instance. And I've just enjoyed always being creative. I think creativity starts when you're quite young. I did a lot of things like painting pebbles when I was younger. So I've always sort of gone down that route, and I've just really taken my passion for that and transferred it into the PR arena.
I wanted to ask the question about who inspires you, because we know you inspire yourself, which is important from that point of view. But there was a teacher, I believe, in your youth who, again, sort of echoed that by saying, never say can't. There's no such word as can't.
Yes, I went to a school called Claremont Junior School in Blackpool, which actually nowadays is in sort of a very rough area of Blackpool, so it's quite sad. But there were some great teachers there. And this lady, Mrs. Hamer, that was her catchphrase. Whatever you did, she would say, oh, there's no such word as can't. So you were told that you had to try everything and have a go at everything. And I suppose that's what I've done during my career.
Jumping around a little bit, but I've attempted to actually, in fact, we will finish this particular interview with a sample of Dido and No White Flag. Why is that particularly significant as a piece of music for yourself in terms of listening to the images that it developed?
Yeah, I think because there are times in your life and in business where you will go through rough patches, and there was a time, I think, when we sort of had a rough patch at Catapult. It would have been very easy to close the door and just think, I don't want to come in anymore, but I use that song to inspire me to think, no, carry on fighting, carry on through it all, you'll get through it. There's no such word as can't. So, yeah, that song summed it up.
Never give up, never surrender. That's the classic line, which I think comes from Galaxy Quest, but that's a different line entirely, really. So life continues. Clearly, the public relations industry is changing, it's evolving, it's working through all sorts of things. You've moved away. Obviously, Catapult is still there, Rogue Elephants is around, but you've also become a children's author.
I have, yes. Something I always wanted to do. So, actually, Rogue Elephants started that journey because it gave me the capacity to write.
Not Nelly the Elephant, surely.
No, I decided that I did have time in my life to write. Rogue Elephants proved that. So having got into that discipline of writing, I decided that I could write this children's story. I had actually started it in 2010, but I brought it out and finished it off again last year. Launched the first one in September, launched a second one in March, April this year at Bologna. And are now sort of taking it around the world, just been to the Frankfurt Book Fair. So that's been a very exciting departure.
And in terms of your colleagues and the folk who sort of know you as obviously the genius behind Catapult PR, and they suddenly say, she's now turning her hands to children's authoring, etc. Is there no limit to this woman's talents, etc.? Have people sort of said, oh, is it going to be a case of taking your bag and saying and waving goodbye to the circus in a kind of Nelly Elephant way?
Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? No, definitely not. I work by day. I have my day job and I do my writing now just usually on a Sunday. So it's just like a one day a week thing. But it's given me a lot of diversity. It's taught me that I perhaps want to do some different things in my day job. I've started going into some of the Manchester agencies freelancing for a bit of something different to do. And it's just provided such a lot of fun. I go into schools now. I do creative writing workshops with Key Stage 2 children, which I find really rewarding because a lot of them aren't very skilled when I get there, but they develop really quickly once they use their imagination. So I feel like their mother by the time I leave. So I'm just enjoying everything, I think, and the books have really sort of brought a lot of zest into life, I suppose.
You've met some of our students here at the University of Lincoln. Your thoughts so far?
I was really impressed with the creative ideas they came up with. I asked them to think of a name of an agency that they would launch themselves, and they had some great ideas, not just about the name, but also about how they could actually launch it, some innovative things they could send to people. So, yes, I was very impressed.
Well, that bodes well for future various other things. And as you kind of tour the country and devise with your writing, with the Catapult PR, et cetera, if we asked you in six words to give us the narrative of Jane Hunt, what would six words would those be?
Oh, goodness me. Crazy woman, slightly wacky, passionate practitioner.
I think that's perfect. Absolutely. Jane had a little surprise as to why you picked up the award from the CIPR, organisations at CIPR Excellence Awards in 2012, the best freelance PR practitioner, of course, managing director of Catapult PR. Delighted that you're actually with us and spent some time with us today. And hopefully we'll feature you again as a fairly regular telephonic contactee as well.
Oh, well, I'd like that. Yes, thank you.
Excellent. Just a little piece we did earlier in the week with Jane Hunt, of course, author and indeed PR guru, part of the Lincoln School of English and Journalism guest lecture series. Another one up, of course, next Monday with Mark Nichols. He'll be talking about embedding raw war reporting. But for them today, the Midweek Drive Morning Edition about to wrap up. Thanks to Jane Hunt, as mentioned, Richard Fitzwilliams, Emma Timpson, Ian Lennox, Jessica Ward, Joe Hamilton, William Sitwell, Andy Robertson, Stephen Foden, and Joel Brannan Bravo. And you, of course, dear listener, thanks for being with us for the last couple of hours here, or however long you have been with us on sirenonline.co.uk or Siren 107.3 FM. That's it. Happy trails. We're out of here. Back again with the Midweek Drive next Wednesday. But of course, great music continues and tunes and, of course, shows on Siren. We've got the fabulous Motor City Resonation at noon and, of course, No Adults Allowed. Plus, of course, Drive Time between 5 and 7 this evening on Thursday, the 23rd of October. Happy Thursday.